You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Christiana Bryan, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History, 12 lectures, this is Lecture 7, given on the 19th of May, 1917, in Munich. Today I will take as a starting point something that might guide us in understanding what surrounds us and the questions we face. Our times need to be grasped in such a way that human beings can place themselves into their midst, in possession of a deeper and more spiritual understanding. Yet on every hand, there is a deep aversion to spiritual conceptions of all things human. This aversion is actually such that any attempt at a spiritual understanding, a comprehension of such impulses as seek to underpin our difficult times, is rejected from the outset as impossibly fantastical and childish. Nonetheless, the reflections we are able to pursue together here, and which cannot, understandably, address immediate conditions, as you know they simply cannot, are dedicated to what can lead in some measure to our own understanding, and can with some effort arrive at truly more profound points of departure. In order to understand times in which the deepest human forces are to some extent churned into disarray, times in which those deepest human forces are also at work, if for the majority quite unconsciously, it is essential that we don't just talk around all sorts of ideals and topics, but that we seek our understanding from a higher vantage point, one spanning the entire evolution of humankind in a general sense. We have always sought, within our spiritual scientific studies, to arrive at a broader overview across human evolution, and the most diverse aspects of this have been covered. Today I would like to bring something from yet another slightly different perspective. We know that a contributory factor within human evolution was undergoing what we call the Great Atlantean Catastrophe or Flood. We know that those now living as humankind can be traced back to certain evolutionary conditions that pertained before that Atlantean flood, and that we usually designate those early post-Atlantean epochs as ancient India, the second as ancient Persia, the third as Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian, the fourth as Greco-Roman. We inhabit the fifth and have to see how this fifth era is to be sloughed off as we move into the sixth. Now, it is a matter of seeing how inwardly, how spiritually, I would almost say how humanly, evolution among humanity could proceed, how it could take place at all after the Atlantean catastrophe. People who are generally averse to seeing things in context today tend to think a human being is a human being and the way souls are configured today is the same as it has always been since humankind has existed. Retracing in reverse order the way in which humanity is viewed nowadays, one does, albeit, arrive at primitive conditions, which thereafter descend into animality. This materialistic interpretation of evolution cannot stand its ground in face of a spiritual scientific method of observing. For the further and ever further we go back in human evolution, the more do we find that the fundamental impetus, the forces underlying evolution, become increasingly spiritual. Though, if we are seeking accurate insight, we first need to grapple toward the right concept of what is spiritual. The fourth post-Atlantean epoch is of prime importance for today's age, the most significant in the context of the Earth's entire evolution. It is the age into which the mystery of Golgotha radiates. It challenges us to view the preceding times as a kind of preparation for the mystery of Golgotha, and the times following it as a fulfillment of the impetus brought about by the mystery of Golgotha. However, if we go back over Atlantean evolution, we find that the fifth epoch within Atlantean evolution is the most crucial in the span between Lemurian times and our own. For it is that fifth age in Atlantean evolution of human life that is the most incisive, and where we find the point of origin for what we may call the predominantly soul-level development of post-Atlantean times. Going back into Atlantean times, we do not find the animal humanity of which materialistically determined Darwinism is so fond of speaking. We find a humanity possessing a life far more dampened or dulled than post-Atlantean humans. When speaking of dullness of soul life, one would like to say, though the comparison remains a superficial one, the dimmed, dreamlike soul life of Atlantean times resembles the dimly dreamlike soul life of present higher mammals. However, this would be an entirely lame and limping comparison, because present-day animals do not experience in their dimly dreamlike consciousness anything like what the humans experienced in their own dreaming consciousness during and almost until the end of the fifth Atlantean epoch. What then is the essential hallmark of ancient dreamlike Atlantean consciousness? Forgive me if what I say sounds materialistic, but one only recognizes what is material once one has command over it, when one is aware of spiritual stimuli. So the main trait of humanity in those times was that they lived such that their soul life and their life of eating and nourishment were very closely allied. You might object that a close enough relationship exists between the soul life of some modern people and what they consume. That's quite correct, and we know that large swathes of present humanity in no way underestimate eating. That in itself need not be designated a reproach. But the difference between the inner experience of tasting food, that feeling of well-being experienced by modern humans when combining food with corporeality, and what Atlantean humanity experienced, it is about them that I am now speaking, is actually a great difference. Atlantean humans would eat, they ate this nutrient or another, taking each substance into themselves, and while combining each with their physical existence, conscious knowledge would arise within them as to which elemental spirit had suffused that material. They would not, in the manner of modern humans, gulp material down in colossal unconsciousness, but were conscious with which elemental spirits they were amalgamating during the process of combining material with their corporeal existence. Their metabolism was simultaneously a spiritual exchange, their mutual interaction with elemental spirits. It was the case that we could designate materials as bearers of one or another elemental spirit's impulsion, or even as a being, such that human beings felt, with their food, that spiritual forces were entering them. In digesting this, it was felt that a spiritual stimulus was at work within, that the human was not simply sitting and digesting as they would today, but that they were physically saturated by one or another spiritual element. Thus, materialism, such as it holds sway today, could not possibly exist. You could not claim only to believe in existential mortality, because spiritual stimuli pervaded both human and their digestion. In one sense, one only had to eat to be an anti-materialist. Descending into the dim dullness of subconsciousness is an essential achievement of this fifth Atlantean epoch. Eating and digesting became to some extent less spiritual, yet there remained something in the sixth Atlantean epoch which was more spiritual, and that was breathing. Today, when human beings breathe in or out, it comes into their awareness that they are breathing air in or out. That, at least, is what a chemist will tell us. In remote times, this was not only conscious, but, and this persisted throughout the sixth Atlantean epoch, humans were aware that in breathing in, they were inhaling spiritual elemental forces into themselves, and in breathing out, they were exhaling elemental spiritual forces. From its outset, breathing has been an inherently soul-spiritual process, and cannot be seen as a purely corporeal physical activity. During the last Atlantean epoch, which had until then pertained, diminished somewhat, and later remained only as a memory, when hearing tones or sounds and seeing colors and awareness remained, that in the tone that could be heard and the color that could be seen, spiritual forces were radiating into eyes in vision, into interior life in the hearing of sounds. All this was present in the dim consciousness of those times. Humans achieved more lucid consciousness, but at the cost of their more spiritual consciousness. And they had to give up the spiritually transfused mutuality of their interrelationship with the outer world. Each age has its particular idiosyncrasies. Just as individual humans traverse the ages of life and their effects on the disposition of body and soul are varied, so does humanity's entire evolution go through various states, and later conditions differ from earlier ones. It would be foolish for someone of 50 or 60 to believe that what constitutes their physical spiritual identity could conjure back their state between 10 and 20. It is just as laughable not to be able to distinguish between the various stages of life and their specific qualities. Likewise, it is eccentric to think that what pertains in later ages of life's evolution was necessarily species appropriate at earlier ages. Things never return, and they differ in successive stages of life more than you might think. I have taken it upon myself to find out something about the stages of human life in post-Atlantean times. Anyone just proceeding from analogies can also look at human evolution and say to themselves, just as an individual goes through childhood, youth, adulthood, and old age, so also does humanity as a whole. However, if you observe properly and delve into the actual interrelation between facts, that is not the case. You can't simply rely on analogies. Only when you take spiritual science seriously can you find what underlies matters. And it appeared to me that this was something different from what one might perhaps summarize by saying that similarly to an individual human being, humanity goes through stages of youth, adulthood, and old age. But this is not so. I found out that humanity in the first post-Atlantean cultural epoch, that of ancient India, was indeed at a certain stage of life, though not at one which can be equated with youth, but can instead be compared with an individual aged between 56 and back to 49. So that if one wants to compare the age of humanity as a whole with a period in an individual's life, it should not be compared with youth, but with this riper span. Following this comes the cultural epoch of ancient Persia. In developing further, humanity undergoes an age span comparable with an individual life that is not youthful, but ranges backward from 49 to 42. Individuals grow older, but humanity grows younger. The Egyptian cultural period, therefore, has to be compared in individual terms with a stage of life between 42 and 35. The Greco-Roman cultural period is comparable with an individual stage between 35 and 28, and the present fifth post-Atlantean cultural period can be compared with an individual's age between 28 and 21. If we ask, how old is present-day humanity? We would need to answer, it is currently aged around 27. You only realize all that has contributed to humankind once this remarkable mystery of evolution is presented to your soul, for that is how this comparative matter actually stands. All this has definite consequences with regard to human life on Earth. What is entailed in that, during the first post-Atlantean cultural epoch, the whole of humanity experienced an age between 56 and 49. It means an individual human being would, of course, experience that they were, firstly, 1, 2, or 3 years old, but the fundamental feature of humanity, into which each individual settled, presented a quality which an individual person only experienced between the ages of 49 and 56. That is why so much original, archetypically elemental human knowledge comes to the fore in that epoch. Wisdom at which we can wonder, in a humanity so old, a humanity which had, as it were, settled into such maturity and age. A whippersnapper of 25 would absorb, from the aura of humanity, whatever was filled with wisdom, much as one would from an older person. Wisdom was dispensed over all humankind, morality was absorbed, and through growing into oneness with the aura of humanity, wisdom was valued, much as one would value a gray-haired head for the reason that it had matured into grayness. Thus did a feeling of devotion and piety flow out over human cultural life, which was both natural and taken for granted. This had the further effect that people, in respect of their individual development, could grow beyond what were gifts common to all only when they reached the age of 56. Only then could you speak of really individual development. Only then could individuals raise themselves above the groundswell of what approached everyone externally. Actually, many people did not achieve such inner development as corresponds with the maturity between the ages of 49 and 56. They were regarded as children. They felt like children who can sense all around them the spiritual contents of humanity's age. The following age, that of ancient Persia, brought forth fewer lofty revelations and cultural impulses than the wise elders of the first post-Atlantean epoch had shared with humanity through their association with spiritual beings. All humankind evinced only a maturity comparable with the individual human stage of life between ages 49 and 42. Those who wished to outgrow the general aura of humanity could only undertake this after age 49. Yet these grew, through their individual progress, into a maturity that could only blossom after the age of 49. Similarly, during the Egypto-Chaldean epoch, the aura into which human beings grew may be compared with the individual's stage in life between the ages of 42 and 35. In Greco-Roman times, this was between 35 and 28. It is a remarkable feature of this Greco-Roman age that the individual's central point in life coincides with the central point in the life of humanity as a whole. It is just that while humanity in general flows downward, the individual ascends. This underlies the unique harmony of Greek culture, a harmony of which present humanity lacks any concept. When a Greek reached 35, they remained, in one sense, an average person, remained forever 35, had they not evolved an individual element in themselves that transcended the aura of humanity as a whole. Care was therefore taken in ancient times that an individual was enabled to evolve ahead and aloft. Then followed the fifth post-Atlantean age, the era in which we now live. During this fifth post-Atlantean period, humanity will live through a stage in life which can be compared with an individual's age between 28 and 21. This means that someone merely abandoning themselves to the universal flow of existence, someone who is only concerned with soul life to the extent that they are simply human, does not progress past the age of 28. If such a person makes no effort to advance their soul individually, to make some spiritual progress, they will remain 28, or rather will not mature past 27. Universal humanity can endow us with no more than it does by aiding us to reach the age of 27. If we do not, in our present age, seek to fire and to bestir ourselves with regard to our individual soul forces, the forces which can elevate us beyond the general universal stream of human existence, then though we live to 100, we will never go beyond the age of 27. Whether we are manual workers, professors, or whatever, if we fail to seek spiritual development, which will endow our souls with concepts such as external humanity cannot give it, we remain 27 in age. We will, of course, grow outwardly older, because time cannot be held up, but our souls only achieve a maturity of 27 in absence of our own evolutionary efforts. You really cannot understand our times if you do not bear in mind the unique trait just described. Over the years, I really have asked many questions pertinent to our time, questions about life, about the evolution of culture, about human misery, about what delights present humankind, what torments it. The key to understanding our present is the fact to which I have just alluded. What is lacking in our times cannot be grasped without focusing on this fact. We encounter philosophies at whose exposition we can only stand amazed, because they remain at the stage of declaiming generalities and have not the slightest ability to pitch into actual reality. Why is this so? I put this question to a single personality. I found that the originator of Eucken's philosophy is a man who has all the fire of a person who cannot transcend the age of 27. Certainly, he can talk, he has, after all, reached a considerable age, in a slightly rough voice, moves with different gestures, and has learned some additional things. But this betokens nothing. His whole manner is no more mature than age 27. You can bear such 27-year-old mannerisms throughout your life. This becomes particularly noticeable when people try to bring their ideas to bear on life, when they harbor ideas about ways in which life is to be managed. Now, we come to a slightly perilous area, so let's approach it by looking for the widest possible examples. I have asked various present-day people, those who have the task of intervening in modern life, making interventions concerning the way in which contemporary phenomena are to be governed by their ideas, how things are going for them. There is a typical person of this sort. I have made great efforts to be direct on the subject and not to beat about the bush, but there is no point in pursuing the matter unless the subject is based in its concrete manifestation. If you go looking for someone who is inherently of the type that can never transcend the age of 27, who will never have more mature thoughts than someone of that age, you find those of this particular type, strangely enough, in the most extraordinary places. For example, in the form of a president of the United States of America. If you study the various programs that person has promoted, they bear the imprint of the type of person who cannot move beyond the age of 27, because their soul has never absorbed the slightest element of anything other than what external life has brought their way. Admittedly, people of this ilk can be gifted to a greater or lesser extent. Talent may well be granted them. But the ideas they develop are, in terms of maturity of outlook, of clout, practicality, and common sense, still only 27, and will mature no further, though they live to be 100, if they don't start to deepen themselves spiritually and to supply their soul with the power of fire from within. We live in an age when we have to direct into our souls whatever is to transcend the age of 27. By 27, people are not practical nor life savvy. They may insist as they will, but they are not yet practical in real life terms. That is the reason why the ideas of Wilson are so impractical and erratic, and why they please so wide an audience. They appeal to people with the same force of delight which youthful ideas can deliver, youthful ideas that take the form of sundry declarations about people's freedom and such like. That's all very nice. That's the way a world is ruled, which demands effectiveness of ideas. You just keep making sweeping declarations about peace, and then war is all the more violently unleashed. One would so much like to engender a feeling for the potential of ideas that really penetrate reality, ideas that have clout, ideas that can grow together with reality, ideas that are merely declarations, nice ideas, particularly youthful ideas that are thought so pleasant, are spread around. But we need ideas that connect human beings with reality. What kind of lovely new idea is it when someone jumps to their feet saying, "The world needs to be oriented anew"? The best that can come from such like are words themselves. That is the one and only nice thing, the words themselves. Because one can then talk about them, and that is certainly pleasant. It's also nice to say, the hardest worker should be deployed in the right job. Great ideas. But what happens when the hardest worker happens to be the nephew or the son-in-law? Nothing actually gets done with nice ideas. Only genuine knowledge of reality carries things out. Only a capacity for knowing what is real and genuine. Here is one of the views to be taken into account if you wish to understand today's culture more deeply. The peculiar nature of the times exhorts us to realize how vital it is for human beings to deepen their souls, and that they seek to achieve, through their own progress and to benefit their later years, that which humanity is no longer being universally given. It is obviously easier to talk in the manner of Eucken, of renewing life, of gaining inner mastery over life, of all sorts of things whereby one can elevate oneself in youthful fashion, all of which are no use for anything but declamations. And if political programs are produced with ideas such as those of Wilson, then the upshots are incalculable. This is much easier than seriously researching, seriously deepening your search for reality and penetrating the hidden impulses of life. If our spiritual scientific movement is truly to have deeper significance, it will, above all, have to salvage the will to delve into humanity's actual evolutionary impetus and be prepared to take hold of the great connections in life. Otherwise, everything in our spiritual science will remain mere theory. And mere theory is worth nothing, however much you may wish to associate with theory feelings that make you seem to be elevated. Only and solely what can delve into life, what is able to grasp life, is of any real value. All sorts of mysticism in which people seek to find this or that within themselves can come up with some very nice results. But we need to be able to look away from ourselves toward humanity's great tasks, so as to understand, above all, what we have need to understand, what we ought to understand. Otherwise, the most important aspects of spiritual science will simply be ignored. Over the years, since we have experienced our anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, a great deal of important things have in fact simply been swept aside, unheeded. If only those dear friends would remember the answer I would always give over many years, whenever I was asked how matters stand regarding reincarnation, because humanity is constantly increasing. If those dear friends might recall the stock answer always given, it could be that humanity will very soon experience the decimation of humankind taking place, especially in Europe. Then you will gauge what was meant if you look back and remember the tone in which this was said. Whenever an increase in population was mentioned, the answer was, a time might soon come when, in the most painful ways, populations may decrease. Spiritual science is not about responding with theories to the superficial and casually felt needs of some people, but of answering questions posed by others that arise from the impulses of the times. In accepting spiritual science, it is preferable to grasp the gravity of what needs to be said and enfold it in one's heart than satisfy curiosity, however upstanding it may appear. This is what I wanted to convey, my dear friends, in the first part of today's considerations, and which, taking due account of the situation, is intended to lead to a deeper understanding of our time, something we will tend to further over these days. As the time designated for general considerations is running out, I would like, without causing anyone to claim I am cutting back on actual anthroposophical content, to move on to something requiring a few words of introduction. But I cannot move on to that before recalling some souls who have left the physical plane for spiritual life, of whom some were close to those sitting here today. It is not possible to go into all their individual names. Our dear friends present will accordingly orient themselves toward the appropriate uprightness of feeling in face of all those who have left the physical plane for the spiritual. That said, I cannot avoid commemorating the name of one man, who, after quite some hindrances, found himself so beautifully to be in heartfelt inner harmony with anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, and who just in recent times had taken on responsibility for representing this in a public-facing capacity, accomplishing much of significance. I am referring to our dear friend Ludwig Deinhardt, at whose relinquishing of his body to the physical elements and departure into spiritual realms, our dear friend Selin spoke such beautiful words. He must be all the more esteemed in that despite quite some resistance, he found accord with our stream, not on the basis of blind faith, nor with a follower's adherence, but lately in ever-worsening times he unstintingly, with all his soul, stepped up to a wide public on behalf of this spiritual stream. I will not shy away from stating explicitly that I count the way in which Ludwig Deinhardt stepped into the public arena on behalf of our movement among the most exceptionally valuable deeds. May I then call to mind Professor Sachs, who died recently and who pursued a great concept throughout his life, a great musical-technical idea, and who always knew how to connect the modest work in which an individual can be immersed with comprehensive ideas, and with whom it was truly uplifting to speak, because what he wanted as a human being always fed into a great artistic will. We can count ourselves fortunate to have such people in our movement. In the wake of such inspiring thoughts, I am obliged, once again, obliged, to raise a less uplifting issue, inasmuch as what in some respects contributed to occurrences, and to the incisive measures I was obliged to take, involved my participation in the spiritual scientific movement to be served by the Anthroposophical Society. Over the course of time, what was to a high degree intended to be a blessing in cultural evolution, the anthroposophical movement, has, due to many of its manifestations, largely evolved into something of an obstruction, rather than the spiritual movement I intended. There is no point in glossing over these issues. That would be particularly pointless, where there is a danger of several aspects connected with the Anthroposophical Society becoming obstacles for anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. Please allow me, therefore, after all, we have worked together for many years and ought to be able to discuss such things without reserve, to deal with this quite openly and in the way it weighs on my heart. In general, one might say, something has become habitual within the Anthroposophical Society that has no right to continue existing in that form, because the judgment of the present world as to what anthroposophy intends is all too easily clouded by what has hitherto been taking place. Taking one detail as our starting point, in the world at large it is often said, and this has become general usage, that I myself come under attack less on account of spiritual scientific matters and more frequently due to some aspects of the society. One of the allegations leveled is particularly prominent, that a blind belief in authority reigns, that there is blind following, and that much is done out of sheer devotion and so forth. Were I to raise my own objection to this, I would have to say, for the most part, what ultimately takes place is what I consider to be the right thing, what I might consider desirable. I do not believe that in any other society so little credence is given to what are actually the specific wishes of someone working within it. Even if that appears otherwise, it is nevertheless the case. Only nobody need take this amiss. Shutting one's eyes and burying one's head in the sand, that is indeed taking it amiss. My dear friends, I have been hearing quite a bit about moods in the local Anthroposophical Society in recent days. When I came into the foyer this evening, I was enveloped in the most devout waft of frankincense. Do not imagine that someone who directs their attention toward practical and inner life would harbor a particular wish for their evening of speaking to be encumbered by reaching for an externality, such as this devout frankincense, or that they might take a headache home with them due to such devout waftings, not to mention how frankincense might look, wafting out, forgive me, into a profane world. It may seem unpleasant to mention things like this, but they are, after all, symptomatic. Just ask whether any such course of action has ever been initiated by me. But that is just by the way. However, the most important thing to me is the way in which the membership feels their connection to be with all that flows through anthroposophically oriented spiritual science in terms of spiritual life. You see, and as you know, a multitude of attacks, partly in print, partly about to be printed, have come into the public domain. If from today's external world there are attacks on spiritual science, it is hardly to be wondered at, nor need one experience them as especially painful. It is only natural and quite obvious. That can be countered. Spiritual science really need not fear factual discussion. Maybe one need also not be embarrassed by what is spiraling aloft from the membership. But the following does indeed gravely harm the strength that our movement should possess. One can say that one thing is certain in this movement, and above all in this society, that the most benevolent intentions and measures, the most compassionate admonishments regarding members' behavior, are here drenched in the most toxic gall and enveloped in a cloak of betrayal, of denigration, of the most highly personal of confrontations, all of which points in a direction very well known to us. Things being done, possibly for mystical reasons, I don't know, in terms of pure invention, total untruth, are actually nowhere more blatantly evident than here. The will to behave rightly in this regard is not nurtured with sufficient energy. In fact, neither is the will to see these matters in their true reality pursued sufficiently energetically. The seriousness underlying a spiritual scientific movement, the scrupulous way in which it has to be represented, should at least be studied. What each individual can contribute naturally depends on their life situations and the most varied circumstances. But you can at least study what exists and not give yourselves up to all manner of mad notions. Objective factualness and an absence of personality-based bias is especially needful within a movement dedicated to purely spiritual perspectives. And nothing is more destructive than when those most personal interests, vanity, or ambition jut into the ranks of our movement. Certainly such things crop up in masked or embellished guise, but we need to look for their true countenance, observing them such that we arrive at the truth of a matter. If anyone writes about a series of offenses or disputes, knowing perfectly well what motivates them, knowing perfectly well how what is being attacked ought to be due to the unique character of spiritual science, then they are not doing enough, if they just refute everything sentence by sentence. Stating and refuting can achieve much, sometimes everything, but very often it is not a case of what is being said. The reasons may lie somewhere quite different. If somebody tenders a piece of writing to the Philosophic Anthroposophic Press, and it has to be rejected, and the person concerned becomes an antagonist, then the original causes are not to be sought in the articles proffered by that individual, but elsewhere. One doesn't discover the truth if the most important aspect, the actual reasons, retreat into the background. If a person concocts some attack or other based on specious esoteric effects, their foolishness is unmistakable to anyone who is not blind, and you would be going astray if you failed to trace utter fabrications back to their factual context. It could be that someone is behind them, say someone who once lived in a small central German town, who suddenly hatches the idea of becoming a prominent figure. First, they might seek to become imposing on a small scale, then by writing to Frau Dr. Steiner and asking how they should transcend their narrow, small-town circumstances. Should they marry into a business or effect upward mobility by other means? When it is then indicated that we cannot concern ourselves with decisions about marriage and so forth, they are still not put off. Things move on. They come and take part in some events, perhaps introducing themselves in a large meeting and in full voice declaiming a Schiller poem without having the slightest idea about speech. Laughter might follow. Their ambition is insulted. Later they wish to be a great painter, and they pursue this idea to some extent. Everything is done to support them in their learning, and they are welcomed. The person concerned wants only to become an artist, but finds learning uncomfortable. They don't actually want to become an artist, they want to be one. And if others can do no more, out of their own inner conviction, than offer learning advice, that's construed as insulting. They are, after all, a genius, and it is a cheek to suggest that they need to train. Others do what they can to support this person's learning, but that in itself is insulting. Further scenarios along these lines could be cited. Such are the true reasons why someone would feel they have to become an enemy of such an awful society. All sorts of material is then written. What is written is almost beside the point. Much else could, of course, be written because the real causes lie elsewhere. And so it may continue, and it probably will, and may take on quite different dimensions. All such things have, in fact, not the slightest to do with spiritual science itself. But they can develop with great intensity from out of a society attempting to establish itself, not upon the objective basis, which spiritual science itself can provide, but within which all manner of cliquish personal social relationships are sought. As you see, I am merely alluding to a tendency. It may be possible to say more in the coming days, yet all this does not originate in spiritual science itself, but can be traced back to prevailing notions about what should happen in the society. It is precisely those who have been most cared for who most often do the rounds in spreading denigration and sheer fabrication. It is for reasons such as these, my dear friends, that I need to reach for incisive measures. I beg you at least really to name both two parts of this present reprimand, so that no further aspersions nor betrayals arise, as might happen were only one part to be passed on. If a reproach such as this is hard for some to take, then please remember that it is as hard for me as for those concerned, and that I am just as pained that it is necessary. So please don't turn to me, but to those who have caused this reprimand. Look in that direction for causes, but also look for what has to happen in future by recognizing, when looking in that direction, the source of such disloyalty. It is most frequent where personal issues come into play. Certainly I have stood by everyone requesting personal advice. As regards esoteric matters, personal information tended on the whole to be somewhat superfluous. As for esoteric issues, I will always take care that a good alternative is available. But because personal issues have led to this point, it is essential that from now on everything takes place in full public light. I will take care that each can come into their own esoterically, but I will no longer be receiving on behalf of the society those seeking so-called private esoteric consultations. I will, without exception, have to end these private meetings so that they do not become a source of denigratory material. If that is difficult for anyone, this measure has become necessary for two reasons. Firstly, because consultations are not essential for the pursuit of esoteric life. I will bring proof of this very soon. You will shortly have a full replacement for the discontinued meetings, which so often resulted in members bringing issues that had nothing to do with esoteric life. Secondly, because in so doing I am recording that the claim that people's inner lives are not being cared for is one drawn out of thin air. Just read title Knowledge of Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? It is not required for anyone to achieve a personal goal within a certain period of time. The second aspect inherent in this measure, one which I beg you not to forget, is that I absolve everyone who has hitherto had private consultations of any undertaking or promise, something anyway never given, of any obligation not to speak about the private consultations. As far as I'm concerned, anyone can say as much as they like about what I discussed with them, as I have nothing to hide. Whoever so wishes can share everything. Everything from the past can also be placed in the full glare of the public domain. This is the way in which we will best achieve a distinction between lies and truth. It will be the best means of creating a benchmark against which the level of duplicity within our movement can be assessed. But these two measures belong together. I will say it yet again. Those only sharing the first part of this reprimand are not presenting it in its true light. They belong together. I would still like to mention one more thing, my dear friends. If this is difficult for some, then please turn to those local places you will most easily find. Turn to those who have made these measures necessary. It is not acceptable that what the spiritual scientific movement ought to be for the world should be made impossible by cliquishness within the Anthroposophical Society, because precisely in this way is the living element at the very core of spiritual science exposed to the misunderstandings of the world at large. Do you really think that all the tasks that need to be undertaken in the context of the society are accomplished for my personal satisfaction? I have been accused of deriving from the society some benefit for this or that project, because, for instance, building work in Dornach had to be undertaken. Do you believe that I could personally have had more concern invested in the Dornach building than any other member who takes our work seriously? Or that I could have been personally ambitious in seeing it built? Had the building not become possible, I would have been the very last person not to subscribe to its necessity. What the Dornach building was required for vital reasons to represent could not be embodied in any other way than that dictated by inherent lawfulness. The drastic measures just mentioned must ultimately be adhered to because, though I have been talking about this for decades, the seriousness of my words has never been taken to heart. Perhaps now that these measures are in place, they will be. Other societies exist in which behavior of the sort occurring in this society has not occurred. This, my dear friends, had to be said for the sake of our friendship, and could not be allowed to remain unsaid. Whoever is serious about the Anthroposophical movement will find their way, even if in face of the seriousness of the situation, measures such as these become necessary. For the movement as such is too sacred to be allowed to be extinguished just on account of assorted personal aspirations, in which direction more than enough has been going on. Those of our dear members, and there are very many such, who work out of devotion and sacrifice in the movement and in the society will be the last to complain about the measures imposed and will consider them all important. I don't think I'll be misunderstood, particularly by those who are genuinely and seriously concerned for our movement. They will concede that I am justified. There will also be those who will say, I am wrong. I will be content to accept that judgment. Time has moved on. I will continue tomorrow with the reflections I have instigated, and perhaps add to what I have had to say about aspects of the society. It has often been very hard to watch some of this. The end of Lecture 7.